Chapter 25. This morning, a solution to the problem of stuckness was discussed, the classic badness caused by traditional reason. Now it's time to move to its romantic parallel, the ugliness of the technology traditional reason has produced. The road has twisted and rolled over desert hills into a little narrow thread of green surrounding the town of Whitebird, then proceeded on to a big fast river, the Salmon, flowing between high canyon walls. Here the heat is tremendous and the glare from the White Canyon rock is blinding. We wind on and on through the bottom of the narrow canyon, nervous about fast-moving traffic and oppressed by the fiery heat. The ugliness the Sutherlands were fleeing is not inherent in technology. It only seemed that way to them because it's so hard to isolate what it is within technology that's so ugly. But technology is simply the making of things, and the making of things can't by its own nature be ugly, or there would be no possibility for beauty in the arts, which also include the making of things. Actually, a root word of technology, techne, originally meant art. The ancient Greeks never separated art from manufacture in their minds, and so never developed separate words for them. Neither is the ugliness inherent in the materials of modern technology, a statement you sometimes hear. Mass-produced plastics and synthetics aren't in themselves bad. They've just acquired bad associations. A person who's lived inside stone walls of a prison most of his life is likely to see stone as inherently ugly material, even though it's also the prime material of sculpture, and a person who's lived in a prison of ugly plastic technology that started with his childhood toys and continues through a lifetime of junky consumer products is likely to see this material as inherently ugly. But the real ugliness of modern technology isn't found in any material or shape or act or product. These are just the objects in which the low quality appears to reside. It's our habit of assigning quality to subjects or objects that gives this impression. The real ugliness is not the result of any objects of technology, nor is it, if one follows Phaedrus's metaphysics, the result of any subjects of technology, the people who produce it, or the people who use it. Quality or its absence doesn't reside in either the subject or the object. The real ugliness lies in the relationship between the people who produce the technology and the things they produce, which results in a similar relationship between the people who use the technology and the things they use. Phaedrus felt that at the moment of pure quality perception, or not even perception, at the moment of pure quality, there is no subject and there is no object. There is only a sense of quality that produces a later awareness of subjects and objects. At the moment of pure quality, subject and object are identical. This is the tat tuam asi truth of the Upanishads, but it's also reflected in modern street argot. Getting with it, digging it, grooving on it are all slang reflections of this identity. It is this identity that is the basis of craftsmanship in all the technical arts. And it is this identity that modern, dualistically conceived technology lacks. The creator of it feels no particular sense of identity with it. The owner of it feels no particular sense of identity with it. The user of it feels no particular sense of identity with it. Hence, by Phaedrus's definition, it has no quality. That wall in Korea that Phaedrus saw was an act of technology. It was beautiful, but not because of any masterful intellectual planning or any scientific supervision of the job or any added expenditures to stylize it. It was beautiful because the people who worked on it had a way of looking at things that made them do it right unselfconsciously. They didn't separate themselves from the work in such a way as to do it wrong. There is the center of the whole solution. The way to solve the conflict between human values and technological needs is not to run away from technology. That's impossible. The way to resolve the conflict is to break down the barriers of dualistic thought that prevent a real understanding of what technology is. Not an exploitation of nature, but a fusion of nature and the human spirit into a new kind of creation that transcends both. When this transcendence occurs, in such events as the first airplane flight across the ocean or the first footstep on the moon, a kind of public recognition of the transcendent nature of technology occurs. But this transcendence should also occur at the individual level, on a personal basis, in one's own life, in a less dramatic way. The walls of the canyon here are completely vertical now. In many places, room for the road had to be blasted out of it. No alternate routes here, just whichever way the river goes. It may be just my imagination, but it seems the river is already smaller than it was an hour ago. Such personal transcendence of conflicts with technology doesn't have to involve motorcycles, of course. It can be at a level as simple as sharpening a kitchen knife, or sewing a dress, or mending a broken chair. The underlying problems are the same. In each case, there's a beautiful way of doing it, and an ugly way of doing it. And in arriving at the high-quality, beautiful way of doing it, both an ability to see what looks good and an ability to understand the underlying methods to arrive at that good are needed. Both classic and romantic understandings of quality must be combined. The nature of our culture is such that if you were to look for instruction in how to do any of these jobs, the instruction would always give only one understanding of quality, the classic. It would tell you how to hold the blade when sharpening the knife, or how to use a sewing machine, or how to mix and apply glue with the presumption that once these underlying methods were applied, good would naturally follow. The ability to see directly what looks good would be ignored. The result is rather typical of modern technology, an overall dullness of appearance so depressing that it must be overlaid with a veneer of style to make it acceptable. And that, to anyone who is sensitive to romantic quality, just makes it all the worse. Now it's just not depressingly dull, it's also phony. Put the two together, and you get a pretty accurate basic description of modern American technology. Stylized cars, and stylized outboard motors, and stylized typewriters, and stylized clothes. Stylized refrigerators filled with stylized food, and stylized kitchens in stylized houses. Plastic stylized toys for stylized children, who at Christmas and birthdays are in style with their stylish parents. You have to be awfully stylish yourself not to get sick of it once in a while. It's the style that gets you. Technological ugliness syruped over with romantic phoniness in an effort to produce beauty and profit by people who, though stylish, don't know where to start because no one has ever told them there's such a thing as quality in this world, and it's real, not style. Quality isn't something you lay on top of subjects and objects like tinsel on a Christmas tree. Real quality must be the source of the subjects and objects, the cone from which the tree must start. To arrive at this quality requires a somewhat different procedure from the step one, step two, step three instructions that accompany dualistic technology, and that's what I'll now try to go into. After many turns in the canyon wall, we stop for a break under a scrubby little patch of small trees and rocks. The grass around the trees is burned and browned and scattered with litter from picnickers. I collapse into some shade and after a while squint up at the sun, which I haven't really looked at since we entered this canyon. Up there above the canyon walls, it's cool and dark blue and far away. Chris doesn't even go over to see the river, something he'd normally do. Like me, he's tired and content just to sit under the scant shade of these trees. After a while, he says there's an old iron pump, it looks like, between us and the river. He points to it, and I see what he means. He goes over, and I can see him pump water onto his hand and then splash it onto his face. I go over and pump for him, so he can use both hands. Then I do the same. The water feels cold in my hands and face. When done, we walk to the cycle again and climb on and pull back onto the canyon road. Now that solution. Throughout this Chautauqua, so far, this whole problem of technological ugliness has been looked at in a negative way. It's been said that romantic attitudes toward quality, such as the Sutherlands have, are by themselves hopeless. You can't live on just groovy emotions alone. You have to work with the underlying form of the universe, too. The laws of nature, which, when understood, can make work easier, sickness rarer, and famine almost absent. On the other hand, technology based on pure dualistic reason has also been condemned because it obtains these material advantages by turning the world into a stylized garbage dump. Now's the time to stop condemning things and come up with some answers. The answer is Phaedrus's contention that classic understanding should not be overlaid with romantic prettiness. Classic and romantic understanding should be united at a basic level. In the past, our common universe of reason has been in the process of escaping, rejecting the romantic, irrational world of prehistoric man. It's been necessary since before the time of Socrates to reject the passions, the emotions, in order to free the rational mind for an understanding of nature's order, which was as yet unknown. Now it's time to further an understanding of nature's order by reassimilating those passions which were originally fled from. The passions, the emotions, the affective domain of man's consciousness are a part of nature's order too, the central part. At present, we're snowed under with an irrational expansion of blind data gathering in the sciences because there's no rational format for any understanding of scientific creativity. At present, we are also snowed under with a lot of stylishness in the arts, thin art, because there's very little assimilation or extension into underlying form. We have artists with no scientific knowledge and scientists with no artistic knowledge, and both with no spiritual sense of gravity at all. And the result is not just bad, it is ghastly. The time for real reunification of art and technology is really long overdue. At the Deweses, I started to talk about peace of mind in connection with technical work, but got laughed off the scene because I brought it up out of the context in which it had originally appeared to me. Now I think it is in context to return to peace of mind and see what I was talking about. Peace of mind isn't at all superficial to technical work. It's the whole thing. That which produces it is good work, and that which destroys it is bad work. The specs, the measuring instruments, the quality control, the final checkout, these are all means toward the end of satisfying the peace of mind of those responsible for the work. What really counts in the end is their peace of mind, nothing else. The reason for this is that peace of mind is a prerequisite for a perception of that quality which is beyond romantic quality and classic quality, and which unites the two, and which must accompany the work as it proceeds. The way to see what looks good and understand the reasons it looks good, and to be at one with this goodness as the work proceeds, is to cultivate an inner quietness, a peace of mind, so that goodness can shine through. I say inner peace of mind. It has no direct relationship to external circumstances. It can occur to a monk in meditation, to a soldier in heavy combat, or to a machinist taking off that last 10,000th of an inch. It involves unself-consciousness, which produces a complete identification with one's circumstances, and there are levels and levels of this identification, and levels of quietness, quite as profound and difficult of attainment as the more familiar levels of activity. The mountains of achievement are quality discovered in one direction only, and are relatively meaningless and often unobtainable unless taken together with the ocean trenches of self-awareness, so different from self-consciousness, which result from inner peace of mind. This inner peace of mind occurs on three levels of understanding. Physical quietness seems the easiest to achieve, although there are levels and levels of this, too, as attested by the ability of Hindu mystics to live buried alive for many days. Mental quietness, in which one has no wandering thoughts at all, seems more difficult, but can be achieved. But value quietness, in which one has no wandering desires at all, but simply performs the acts of his life without desire, that seems the hardest. I've sometimes thought this inner peace of mind, this quietness, is similar to, if not identical with, the sort of calm you sometimes get when going fishing, which accounts for much of the popularity of this sport. Just to sit with the line in the water, not moving, not really thinking about anything, not really caring about anything either, seems to draw out the inner tensions and frustrations that have prevented you from solving problems you couldn't solve before, and introduced ugliness and clumsiness into your actions and thoughts. You don't have to go fishing, of course, to fix your motorcycle. A cup of coffee, a walk around the block, sometimes just putting off the job for 5 minutes of silence is enough. When you do, you can almost feel yourself grow toward that inner peace of mind that reveals it all. That which turns its back on this inner calm and the quality it reveals is bad maintenance. That which turns toward it is good. The forms of turning away and toward are infinite, but the goal is always the same. I think that when this concept of peace of mind is introduced and made central to the act of technical work, a fusion of classic and romantic quality can take place at a basic level within a practical working context. I've said you can actually see this fusion in skilled mechanics and machinists of a certain sort, and you can see it in the work they do. To say that they are not artists is to misunderstand the nature of art. They have patience, care, and attentiveness to what they're doing. But more than this, there's a kind of inner peace of mind that isn't contrived, but results from a kind of harmony with the work in which there's no leader and no follower. The material and the craftsman's thoughts change together in a progression of smooth, even changes until his mind is at rest at the exact instant the material is right. We've all had moments of that sort when we're doing something we really want to do. It's just that somehow we've gotten into an unfortunate separation of these moments from work. The mechanic I'm talking about doesn't make this separation. One says of him that he is interested in what he's doing, that he's involved in his work. What produces this involvement is, at the cutting edge of consciousness, an absence of any sense of separateness of subject and object. Being with it, being a natural, taking hold. There are a lot of idiomatic expressions for what I mean by this absence of subject-object duality, because what I mean is so well understood as folklore, common sense, the everyday understanding of the shop. But in scientific parlance, the words for this absence of subject-object duality are scarce, because scientific minds have shut themselves off from consciousness of this kind of understanding in the assumption of the formal dualistic scientific outlook. Zen Buddhists talk about just sitting, a meditative practice in which the idea of a duality of self and object does not dominate one's consciousness. What I'm talking about here in motorcycle maintenance is just fixing, in which the idea of a duality of self and object doesn't dominate one's consciousness. When one isn't dominated by feelings of separateness from what he's working on, then one can be said to care about what he's doing. That is what caring really is, a feeling of identification with what one's doing. When one has this feeling, then he also sees the inverse side of caring, quality itself. So the thing to do when working on a motorcycle, as in any other task, is to cultivate the peace of mind which does not separate one's self from one's surroundings. When that is done successfully, then everything else follows naturally. Peace of mind produces right values produce right thoughts produce right actions produce work, which will be a material reflection for others to see of the serenity at the center of it all. That was what it was about that wall in Korea. It was a material reflection of a spiritual reality. I think that if we are going to reform the world and make it a better place to live in, the way to do it is not with talk about relationships of a political nature, which are inevitably dualistic, full of subjects and objects and their relationship to one another, or with programs full of things for other people to do. I think that kind of approach starts at the end and presumes the end is the beginning. Programs of a political nature are important end products of social quality that can be effective only if the underlying structure of social values is right. The social values are right only if the individual values are right. The place to improve the world is first in one's own heart and head and hands. and then work outward from there. Other people can talk about how to expand the destiny of mankind. I just want to talk about how to fix a motorcycle. I think that what I have said has more lasting value. A town called Riggins comes up, and we see a lot of motels, and afterward the road branches away from the canyon and follows a smaller stream. It seems to head upward into forest. It does, and soon the road becomes shaded by tall, cool pines. Resort signs appear. We wind higher and higher into unexpectedly pleasant, cool, green meadows surrounded by pine forests. At a town called New Meadows, we fill up again and buy two cans of oil, still surprised at the change. But as we leave New Meadows, I note the long slant of the sun and a late afternoon depression begins to set in. At another time of day, these mountain meadows would refresh me more, but we've gone too long. We pass Tamarack, and the road drops down again from green meadows into dry, sandy country. I guess that's all I want to say for the Chautauqua today. It's been a long session, and perhaps the most important one. Tomorrow I want to talk about things that seem to turn one toward quality and turn one away from quality. Some of the traps and problems that come up. Strange feelings from the orange sunlight on this sandy, dry country so far from home. I wonder if Chris feels it too. Just a sort of unexplained sadness that comes over each afternoon when the new day is gone forever and there's nothing ahead but increasing darkness. The orange turns to dull bronze light and continues to show what it has shown all day long, but now it seems to show it without enthusiasm. Across those dry hills, within those little houses in the distance, are people who've been there all day long, going about the business of the day, who now find nothing unusual or different in this strange darkening landscape as we do. If we were to come upon them early in the day, they might be curious about us and what we're here for. But now, in the evening, they'd just resent our presence. The workday is over. It's time for supper and family and relaxation and turning inward at home. We ride unnoticed down this empty highway through this strange country I've never seen before. And now a heavy feeling of isolation and loneliness becomes dominant and my spirits wane with the sun. We stop in an abandoned schoolyard, and under a huge cottonwood tree I change the oil in the cycle. Chris is irritable and wonders why we stopped for so long, not knowing perhaps that it's just the time of day that makes him irritable. But I give him the map to study while I change the oil, and when the oil is changed, we look at the map together and decide to have supper at the next good restaurant we find and camp at the first good camping place. That cheers him up. At a town called Cambridge, we have supper, and when we are finished, it's dark out. We follow the headlight beam down a secondary road toward Oregon, to a little sign saying, Brownlee Campground, which appears to be in a draw of the mountains. In the dark, it's hard to tell what sort of country we're in. We follow a dirt road under trees and past underbrush to some campers' pull-ins. No one else seems to be here. When I shut the motor off and we unpack, I can hear a small stream nearby. Except for that and the chirping of some little bird, there's no sound. I like it here, Chris says. It's very quiet, I say. Where will we be going tomorrow? Into Oregon. I give him the flashlight and have him shine it where I'm unpacking. Have I been there before? Maybe. I'm not sure. I spread out the sleeping bags and put his on top of the picnic table. The novelty of this appeals to him. This night there'll be no trouble sleeping. Soon I hear deep breathing that tells me he's already asleep. I wish I knew what to say to him, or what to ask. He seems so close at times, and yet the closeness has nothing to do with what is asked or said. Then at other times he seems very far away and sort of watching me from some vantage point I don't see. And then sometimes he's just childish and there's no relation at all. Sometimes, when thinking about this, I thought that the idea that one person's mind is accessible to another's is just a conversational illusion, just a figure of speech. An assumption that makes some kind of exchange between basically alien creatures seem plausible, and that really the relationship of one person to another is ultimately unknowable. The effort of fathoming what is in another's mind creates a distortion of what is seen. I'm trying, I suppose, for some situation in which whatever it is emerges undistorted. The way he asks all those questions, I don't know.